Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice in conversation with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it.
Drew Elliott, welcome to Leave Your Mark.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Are you kidding? I'm so excited to see you. As always, for everyone listening, Drew Elliott is the Senior Vice President, Global Creative Director for MAC Cosmetics. Drew, you joined the company in October 2019 to lead all strategy, conceptualization, and execution of the creative process that drives the global image for MAC. That's major.
It is. And I joined on Halloween. So can you imagine?
Is that significant to you personally?
I think it set the tone. So it's like, let's do a transformation.
I love it. Well, that's not the only thing you've done so far, but it truly is the perfect job for you. Your
Thank you. Previous career
was in the dead center of fashion and pop culture. You went literally from the bottom to the top. You started as an intern at Paper Magazine when you were 18. And then you became marketing director at age of 20. So definitely, you guys listening, Drew is a prodigy child.
No.
Yes, you are. And then you went on to become vice president, chief creative officer, and then co-owner. Okay, I'm sorry. Hello. Your accomplishments and industry recognition reflect your truly visionary eye. And in my opinion, and a lot of other people's opinions, your unique ability to create content that both resonate with global audiences and drive revenue. And who can't forget that you were also a judge on America's Next Top Model, season 23.
The gifts and memes don't allow me to forget.
Oh my God. And, you know, John Dempsey, who I've had the pleasure of having on the podcast previously, who is the executive group president for Estee Lauder, the parent company of MAC, called you a true industry tastemaker who defines our cultural zeitgeist. I mean, that's a pretty amazing statement, and it's totally true. And I have a long history of respect and admiration for you. And we've had fun together working in the past. So I'm so excited for everyone to hear all about you today. So
should we tell people how we met?
Yes, go ahead.
So it all started with the internet. So I guess 2009, we started what was called Twitter Dinner. So
yes.
Basically, myself and Mickey Boardman, we fell in love with a certain set of people on Twitter. And we just DM'd people and asked them if they would come to dinner. And we got a restaurant to give us a place. And we invited our 12 favorite tweeters. And so you were, you know, a very, very early adapter of Twitter. And so you were in the prized seat. And we were so excited to meet you. And now here we are years later.
Oh, my God. And remember, we did those every month. It was such a crew.
We did, and everyone's become quite successful, and everyone's still a maverick as far as the digital space goes.
It's true. So let's talk about you, though, not me.
Okay.
So tell everyone where you grew up. What was your childhood like?
I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana. I was born in a university town, very, very small, literally on like the edge of a cornfield, basically. I had amazing parents. My father was the vice president of Indiana University and then moved into finance. And my mother was an artist. So really kind of it gave me a left brain, a right brain. So my dad would say work hard and my mom would say have fun.
Oh.
And so I think that that's how I've always lived my life. And so, you know, they were dedicated to my education. We drove an hour and a half to school and an hour and a half home. So 3 hours in the car every day. To make sure that I had an education that was surrounded in arts, which I am indebted to them for.
So when you were young, what were you like? I mean, I picture you being just so outgoing. And I know that you were very interested in acting, right?
I was. So I was very interested in acting. I was always a popular outsider, I would say. So I always liked the different thing, but I was always kind of embraced for that. Like I remember when I was in, I think fifth grade, it was the hobby show. You had to show off your hobby and I wanted to do makeup. And so my mother allowed me to set up a makeup station in the gymnasium of Benford Elementary School. And I set up a table and I did special effects makeup. And everyone was like, what are you doing makeup for? That's so weird. And then I would show them, like, I would, you know, did all these prosthetics and all these like transformations. And people were shocked and excited about it. And, you know, I never allowed what I thought people would accept to get in the way of my imagination. And so, you know, I bartered things like I had a Nintendo, I had a Sega, and I would loan them out to kids in the neighborhood if they would be in my plays. I always wanted to be creating things and making things instead of like a playroom or whatever that is. I had a theater in my basement where my mom constructed a stage where I could do like performances. So I was never like any of the kids, but I always tried to include everyone in my projects.
Well, first of all, I love your mom, number one. Number two, I can't believe how full circle you've now come with this new role, given that story. I mean, don't you kind of get chills when you think about that?
You know, when I was thinking about, people are like, oh, have you always loved makeup? And I was like, I have always loved makeup. I mean, I remember watching horror movies and like Stan Winston and like all these like incredible makeup artists. When I was a kid, I went to theater camp. And I actually took an extensive set of makeup classes. And then as the world moved on and I worked in editorial and things like that, not getting ahead of myself, but I was always fascinated with makeup and how it could transform people or make you look completely different or a make under, like anything that was transformational, I loved.
That's incredible. So you moved to New York at the age of 18.
I did.
What drove that decision?
I moved to New York to go to New York University, and I attended a school called Gallatin within New York University, which is a school around individualized study. And what drew me there was I really wanted to build my own major because I wanted to focus on pop culture. So I had this drive in me. I wanted, originally as a kid, I wanted to be an actor, and I went to theatrical camp. And so I learned like the world of entertainment and movies, and a lot of the kids I grew up with became movie stars and all that type of thing. And I loved that, but I realized it wasn't really for me. But I knew what I loved was what made something famous, what made something popular. And so I wanted to understand that from like almost like an anthropological point of view. And so I wanted to dissect culture and what made things famous.
Stacey London's father started that school. Do you know that?
Yes. Yes. Herb London.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, who I know. So he's the one who helped me get into NYU.
Oh my God, that's so funny. What a small world. So, okay, so you're at NYU and you decide you want to do an internship and you find paper. Like, how does that all go?
Yes. So my first summer, so I'm 19 years old, I started interning at Paper. I had always read it. So when at the age of 15, I was a subscriber. And my advisor said, you know, I have a student who is interning at this magazine called Paper. And I was like, oh, I love Paper. I've always loved it. It's the reason I wanted to move to New York. And she's like, well, you should definitely go try it out. And here's the phone number. So I called Diane Drennan, who was the office manager at the time and the intern coordinator. She hired me on the spot. I started the next day. And that's the whole story.
So were you and Mickey interns at the same time? Or what's the timing there?
No, so Mickey's just a tad decade older than me.
Yeah, true. He could have still been an intern.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just kidding. But yes, so Mickey was there. My first job at Paper was I was Mickey's assistant. So that was the first assignment I ever had. And then sadly, he kind of was like, oh, you should go try out some other things. And then I did. And so I kind of moved on to working in events and marketing. And when I was 20, I was made the marketing director.
And which is crazy. So, I mean, obviously you were very entrepreneurial there. Like you got promoted from an intern to a marketing director in a year.
I was. Well, you know, I worked in nightlife prior to that. Like, so to like pay my bills when I was just coming out of college, I worked the doors at nightclubs. I was a host at nightclubs. So I understood like events and like crowd choreography and people. And really, I met all of New York through the nightclubs. And so it made a job working in events and promotions quite simple. So it came naturally to me. I knew the crew to bring and like all of that type of thing. So I was like, I can do this. And so I did it.
Just to be really specific, because I love this. I mean, you worked the door at the Roxy, which I literally was there every Saturday.
Let you in.
I mean, that's the thing. You let me in.
I let you in.
I kid you not. I mean, first of all, there were nights I'd come out of that club at 4 a.m, my car would be towed. That was our home. I mean, and just give people a little color into what the Roxy was like back then.
So I worked at the Roxy on Saturday nights. So it was a very huge, huge party, probably 5,000 people, I would say. It was an old roller skating rink. And I worked for a man named John Blair and Beto. My best friend got me the job. And basically, I mean, it was a huge dance party where they would have very famous DJs. And then every once in a while, Cher would perform, or Madonna would be there, or, you know, Britney Spears would come. So it was always all of these like kind of like surprises. But it was New York nightlife at its peak. And so it was an amazing job. I got paid $100 a week to work there. And it was fabulous. And I got to meet so many people. I remember letting Anderson Cooper and Ian McKellen in through the back door.
Oh my God. Well, you know, for people, I mean, even as a former publicist, like controlling the door is really one of the best jobs you can have. It is such a power networking job.
It also trains you. There's a balance between, you know, being kind and friendly and stern. And also, it really increases your tolerance, I'll say, to, you know, all kinds of falsehoods and misrepresentations and also questioning of your authority. And also, you know, bear in mind, I'm 5'6". I'm quite small. And so dealing with some of these people, some in heels, you know, it could be quite intimidating. And I just remained firm.
What's the craziest story you can remember from that time?
What is the craziest story? So I ran so many events in New York. So that was just one job. So I ended up doing 5 nights a week, actually, as a host and doing all kinds of different things. So, you know, I threw this very large party at the Maritime Hotel. And that's really where it was called the Cuckoo Club. I did it with Eric Conrad and my roommates, Amy and Mackie. And it was really kind of like the epicenter of culture at that moment, because it was everyone who came through would come through. Like, that's where I met Alexander McQueen or Kim Jones, or, you know, we would be sitting at dinner with Bjork and Matthew Barney, and then Victoria Beckham would come. So it was like every night. And to this day, you know, I meet people and they're like, oh, I remember when I used to go to the Maritime, and I was like, oh, that was my party. Like, so I met a lot of New York through those experiences. And, you know, I co-hosted with Amanda Lepore and all of those things. So they used to have a swing. So it was like a gigantic, I mean, the ceilings were like 50 feet tall in the ballroom, and they would lower a swing and I would get on it and just swing and look at all the people and like, you know, throw glitter and like all of this type of thing. And I just remember like being on that swing and being like, wow, this is everything I imagined and more growing up in Indiana.
And I think also that entire experience, I think, really kind of shaped your point of view with everything that you did after that. Because everything, I mean, I know you agree with this. It's like, whether you're working on a physical product like you are now in cosmetics or something more abstract, like culture drives anything that matters.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, pop culture is the main reason we make decisions. It's people love just like spectacle. They love an event. They love a moment in time. They love seeing something that they haven't seen before. And I think taking elements from my life in publishing, my life in events, my life in nightlife, also using my background from NYU, you start breaking down the codes. Like, why do people want to be part of this? Why do people want this thing? Or when you make something that's completely new, how do you engineer it in a way that you know people will be excited about it? And so that's what I've kind of always loved about the different careers that I've had is it's always been at the service of entertaining or surprising a consumer, whether that be a nightclub goer, a magazine reader, or now a cosmetics customer. It's awesome.
So cool. So you spent your whole career at paper pretty much, but then at one point you left to go to the Audience.
I did.
And I remember when you did that. And I feel like you learned some pretty interesting things there. What would you say was the best takeaway you had from that experience?
Well, it was a very interesting job. I worked for a man named Oliver Luckett, who is absolutely a genius. And it was a joint venture with Sean Parker, obviously from Facebook, and Ari Emanuel from William Morris. So it was, you know, kind of like the head of Hollywood, the head of tech, and then Oliver Luckett, who's kind of like the brains behind social architecture. Mm-hmm. So I was learning at the biggest scale. So basically, we took 600 celebrities and put them all on social media and turned them into media properties. So hugely fascinating, because you're getting all kinds of data and information and understanding, you know, what works, understanding, you know, how different audiences behave, how to really program all the different social channels, why things work in different countries. So you're learning all this information. And at the end of the day, it's the creative that drive the analytics. And it's where I kind of like started thinking about this idea of math and magic. So without the magic, without the creative, you can't create the math. So you can't create any of the buzz or the excitement if you don't have the right thing to put in the system. So I really uniquely found that it's like, if I could, you know, engineer creative that would be fascinating, then I could drive the analytics. I could drive the numbers. I could drive the demand.
It's fascinating. And I think, you know, when we all started in digital, it was really about this sort of organic engagement. But now we know it does need to be engineered in a way.
Like engineered in a good way. I think you look at how, whether you're adding an influencer, whether you're adding, you know, a creative execution that no one's ever seen before, whether it's a nuance in a hashtag or whatever it may be, mm-hmm. there are markers in culture that you pick up on and things that you identify, and you start seeing trends. Like when I was working at Paper, I remember I saw this young person in the internet and I was like, oh wow, like the momentum that he's creating inside of his social is enormous. And so I was like, let's do something with him. And so we called his mom and said, could he do a high fashion story with us? And she's like, no, you know, he's very like jeans and a t-shirt. But I convinced them to do it. And it was Cameron Dallas. And now he's obviously a gigantic star. But you start like looking at these things and you start identifying like, oh, that's going to be really a big concept. And you can see it in the numbers. You can see it in how things fly through the social graph. So that's where I've always found my happy place, is like how I dissect the internet and find out what will be that next thing.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, one of the most major things you did was the Break the Internet Kim Kardashian cover at Paper.
Yes.
I mean, that drove 5 million unique visitors to the site in 30 hours.
Right. It was an amazing opportunity. You know, I was talking to Mickey Boardman, who is the editorial director of Paper, and I said, if we have John Paul Goode shoot Kim Kardashian, that will break the internet. And, you know, to Mickey's credit, he's like, well, let's call it that. So it was a concept that I had seen before, that John Paul Goode, who I was very familiar with, it was an image that I knew, because I was looking at, obviously, Kim Kardashian's one of the most famous faces in the world. And I was thinking about how she had such body positivity, and I really wanted to show that off. And so I think showing that off and bringing the theater of the champagne bottle, you know, exploding into the glass that was right on her backside. And so just adding all those with the hashtag Break the Internet. I mean, it just obviously it caused a commotion. I think what was exciting about it is I think it reset publishing in an interesting way. It was like people started gaming their covers and started doing things digitally. You know, even in the design of how we changed the Paper cover, you know, we built it like a meme, right? So it had, you know, the title was like the beginning of the meme, and then the image was always fantastic, and then the payoff was what that was called. So it was even designed as a meme.
I mean, it's visionary. I mean, it's something that people will remember forever, right? So you should be pretty proud of that.
You got to leave your mark.
Oh, Drew.
To your brand.
You once said, at the end of the day, I can't really make anything. I don't take pictures. I don't write stories. I don't style. I have a point of view. That's really profound. Talk to us a little bit about why having a point of view has carried you through your career, made you super successful. And so many people are afraid to have a point of view, especially in the presence of people who might be more important than them, more senior bosses, etc.
Sure. I mean, A, I've never been afraid of bosses or people. I love learning from the best of the best. So I try and surround myself with the greatest thinkers, and I've had the opportunity of working with the most tremendous people in the world. So I've been able to learn a lot. But as far as like my execution, I don't have any of those talents. I can't draw. I can't manipulate photos on Photoshop. There's so many things that I can't do. What I know how to do is assemble the right team of the most talented people to execute on a vision that we all get behind. I think that that's what my talent is to understand how I can maximize the group of amazing talent and how we can work together towards a common goal. And I think that that's what excites me most. And when I can calibrate that team and calibrate the idea, it's fascinating.
Well, I think, though, having a strong point of view, you know, listen, a lot of people have teams. A lot of people don't know how to do things and put teams together. But being decisive and being able to see where you want to end up, I think, is truly your gift, because it is that foresight to like plan out, like all the things you've done have had an end in mind, right? It's like, you know, you were going for breaking the internet on that cover. Like, you know where you want to end. And I think that's an important lesson for people, to be able to think a couple steps ahead, to think about where they want to end up.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, what I always think about is the audience. Like, how are they going to respond to this? If you kind of like use the examples, or you try and do something that everyone else has done, then you're bringing nothing to the culture. And the culture is starving. They're starving for content. They're starving for excitement. So if you bring that nuance or that element that they've never seen before, they'll love you for it. That's what I always look for. And so I have a very clear, always point of view on where I want to go. Is it always right? It's not. And, you know, sometimes you have lemons, but I think you're always kind of like searching for what is the thing that's going to surprise and delight the most. At the end of the day, like, I'm a theater person.
I love it. What's the biggest obstacle you've had to overcome?
I mean, there's so many obstacles. I think that I always try and include my failures. You know, for instance, I didn't get into NYU the first time I tried. You know, and I had to work really hard to get in. I believe so clearly that I belonged in New York, and I belonged in New York University. And so I stopped at nothing to actually make that happen. And so I believe that, yes, you might have obstacles, but there's always a path. Every single thing I've ever done that I'm excited about was a no at the start. And that turning it into the yes made you work that much harder to perfect it at the end.
That's great advice. Your favorite question to ask people is, what is their North Star? How does one find their North Star?
You know it. It's in your gut. Like, my North Star is to entertain people, right? So that's my North Star. And so everything I do is adjacent to that, right? So it's like, whether it's creative or marketing or any of those things, it's all in service of that thing. Because I love to make people excited. It's part of my personality. It's part of like who I am. And so that's my North Star. And so you can open the aperture, and so it could be many things. Mm-hmm. It's not so focused of, I want to have this one specific thing. And, you know, I have so many people who reach out to me on Instagram or whatever it may be, and they say, how can I become famous? How can I become a model? How can I become whatever that thing is? And that to me is, their North Star is the reward, and you never get there. Mm. If your North Star is some type of sensation or feeling or an accomplishment, that's where you can achieve things. And also in a way that you're always learning.
Very smart. So why did you decide to leave this incredible career at Paper and join Mac?
I think, how could you not? You know what I'm saying? It's always been a brand that's been a love mark of mine. I've always loved Mac. When I was 19 years old, I met John Dempsey, you know, and I loved the brand way before then. And I admired the creative. And when I would go into like the stores in Indiana or, you know, be part of the brand, I always felt included, because it was a little off from center, but it was always elegant. It was always cool. It always had quality products, but it was always for someone who wanted to stand out a bit, right?
Yeah, it was really ahead of its time.
Always. It's a brand that I love, and it's a brand that I knew that I could bring my energy to in such a big way, because I know it, I know the codes, I know it, what it's been in the past. And I always think about this idea of nostalgia, where it's like, how do you take the then and make it for now? Like, how do you add the nuance of the new and modernize something that has such beautiful DNA from the past? So preserve that, but give it a new exciting point of view.
I love that. Did you coin that?
I did. I made up Nowstalgia a long time ago.
I think that deserves a trademark or something.
I called an issue of paper that. So, but Nowstalgia is something that's always been part of my belief, because nostalgia is actually the fuel of the internet. So we love to remember something that we've already remembered.
It's true. Very, very true. That's why we have so many flashback days.
Exactly. Throwback Thursday, yep. Flashback Friday. So all of those are built on remembering the times that made you excited.
Can you give us a little inkling as to where you're taking this brand now?
I think, obviously I just started 6 months ago, so it's still brand new. But what I am looking at is that nostalgia piece. How do we tell that brand heritage mm-hmm. in a brand new way? How do we expand the storytelling? How do we bring new and exciting collaborations mm-hmm. to the brand? And just an overall just elevation of the feeling. And I think it's been really interesting. You know, the brand, I've had the luxury of, you know, traveling around the world and seeing how the brand is articulated throughout the world. And it's really amazing how different parts of the world see trend, how different parts of the world see MAC. And so I think I've been taking all of that and distilling kind of the new vision of how I see MAC. Because obviously, you know, James Gager, who was a former creative mm-hmm. director of MAC for many years, I always admired and I always loved. And actually, I flew down to Florida to see him. And I wanted to go down and get his
blessing. Kind of like,
his blessing.
Yeah.
And I did. And that was one of the very important things, because he brought so many amazing images. And so, you know, his main advice was, do what you'll do with it. And I was really excited about that. And having John Dempsey and Philippe, our president, they're just amazing. They're supporters of creative, which I love.
I have chills. I think it is so lovely that you did that. I mean, because it's so respectful of the history, right? I mean, there's so, listen, in fashion especially, it's like a new creative director comes in, you pretend the past never happened, you delete the Instagram account, you're moving on. And I think that's so lovely that you did that.
In the New York I grew up in, it's all about respecting those who came before, all of the amazing art that they brought, or the kind of newness or all of that type of thing. Whether it was, you know, I learned so much from Kim Hastrider at Paper, or I got to work with so many brilliant photographers. And so I look at all these people who have really left their mark on culture, and I always try and, you know, surround myself with those people.
How do you see this time period that we're in right now? Obviously, we're both in quarantine. How do you see coronavirus affecting beauty or not?
I mean, obviously, coronavirus, COVID-19, has had an impact on every industry. You know, as a true, connoisseur of the internet and someone who is obsessive, it's amazing to watch. It's not just beauty, it's every brand. It's amazing to watch every brand pivot. And not just pivot, I think that's almost the wrong word. I think it's modernized at a speed that we weren't necessarily, we didn't know we were going to move at that speed. And so my world and my obsession has always been with how we are interconnected inside of the internet and how we can be together when we might be alone. And so I think we've done incredible things at MAC that I'm really excited about, like, you know, really escalating our virtual try-on experience. And so what is that going to look like? That's absolutely needed. So making sure that you can choose the, you know, foundation you wear to the lipstick you want. So really making sure that we're there with technology, as well as understanding how we can really bring social to life. So there's 20,000 amazing artists around the world who work for MAC. And so really making sure that they can leverage their social systems, how they can go live on Instagram or on WeChat or whatever that may be, and how they can continue to inspire and help people make choices that are around the beauty trends. So it's been actually really interesting to see how people innovate in this time of isolation.
Yeah, I think it's been incredibly inspiring, actually. And in a lot of ways, I think there's a lot of positive end results that are going to come out of this, because, you know, especially working in big corporate cultures, like sometimes it's like steering a yacht. Like, it just doesn't move.
Well, I have to say, you know, Estee Lauder Companies, which is, you know, obviously the parent company of MAC, is, it's really built like a family. So it's, you know, you really get that sensation. So I have always felt like my safety, my health was number one. That's always been the concern. And so everything's been driven through that lens. And, you know, as well as my team and the people around the world, I think everyone's really, you know, worked together. And it's been wonderful kind of getting to know people, because when you're at home and you're dealing with your daily life in the midst of work, it's an interesting time period.
What's your, like, life mantra right now?
Oh, I think it's the one that I started this with. It's what my mom and dad said to me. It's work hard and have fun.
I love that. So how do you ultimately want to leave your mark?
I think I want to leave my mark more in helping others leave theirs. And so I love to help people do their best work or accomplish a dream that they have. That's where I get my greatest excitement, is when someone's achieved something. You know, I've helped young people, young photographers, and given them their first cover. Or, you know, I like to champion young talent and I like to champion young people. I never say no to helping someone find their North Star. So that's how I want to leave my mark, is helping others complete theirs.
Well, I have chills. You're a mentor, like me. And I think that you're so creative. And I know you listed all those things you don't know how to do, but there's like 10 times as many things you do know how to do. And you're not only an incredible talent, but you're a wonderful person. And I'm proud to call you a friend.
Same.
Thanks, Drew. Can't wait to see you IRL one day when we're let out of isolation.
I know why. We'll see you in the very, very near future.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you want to subscribe to my career advice newsletter, Blackboard, you can do so on alizalicht.com. Be sure to follow me on Instagram at alizalichtxo or reach out on Twitter at alizalicht. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.